spark gap transmitters are also very good for suntan.
You, no, good, Ed. KD2FIU input, Roy?
Yes, George. One second. I just want to add that it also adds a nice amount of ozone to the air, just in case you have good lungs and you want to ruin them. But please, go ahead, George.
Good. The 4EA DC discharge has been under control for almost 100 years and illegal, as and you know that. That it absolutely wipes out RF in all levels of spectrum of RF, and you know that. Another thing is with the vacuum tube technology is that, you know, it was good when the transfer resistor compound diode was invented in 1947 by three Bell Laboratory scientists. It's a shame that we didn't go too much further. We did go further for about 15 years with tube technology. However, it could have run parallel for a little bit longer. And that is because of the power capabilities. And people don't understand the triode, the pentode, and they just don't understand what's going on inside the tube. Not to mean that it is superior, but to mean that it did have a place, and it still has a place. Many countries insist that it has a place. KD2FIU, I want to hear from Ed, please.
All I can say is Bardeen, Bretagne, and Shockley invented the transistor. That's all I got.
1947.
Yeah, I was there telling him what to do, even though I was in diapers.
Okay, well, and I do believe that was December 23rd.
Yeah, it sounds about right. I was definitely in diapers. It's about my first birthday.
Thank you, Roy. KD2FIU.
Okay, very good, George. Thank you, Ed. Well, yes, solid-state transistors revolutionized electronics. Everyone our age had a transistor radio, which you couldn't have with vacuum tubes. You had those terrible 9-volt batteries in them, and those lovely little transistors. One of the first things I took apart was a transistor radio. I could figure out what the capacitors did. I could figure out what the inductors did. I could even come to some conclusion with the IF can. But for the life of me, when I popped the can off of a transistor, I didn't have a clue how the heck the damn thing worked.
That's obvious. Hey, you want to hear a good story about me and the transistor radio?
Sure, Ed.
I was in the 11th grade. I had no real interest in electronics. Now, back then, they were doing the, space launches and the like, and the school said, if they're doing a launch, you're allowed to bring in one of the bangle transistor radios and listen, but only during the launch. So it was an announcement they were doing a launch. And it was about expected, but one fellow who I knew, but not all that well, next to me, rips out a crush-proof pack of Marlboro cigarettes with a headphone plugged into it and starts listening. And I was absolutely intrigued. And he showed it to me and said it came out of a magazine article that's come out like about 2 months ago. It was still available. I got the magazine. It was basically I still remember. I probably should go to the schematic to this day by memory. I'm going to drop a second.
Crystal radio with a sliding inductor and a head. A
little bit of advice. I built one up, and I was hooked. And I believe that defined the rest of my life until today.
That article was in Popular Electronics called Build the Half-Pack, Half-Pack AF2P.
I don't recall that. It was not popular electronics. So they had stuff like that left and right. But I don't think that was that particular design. It had AO1 regenerative detector and 3 2107 series of audio amplifiers. And the frame was actually cardboard that fit to the first roof of the back with a magnet wire inductor wrapped around the outside.
And a geranium diode with a 0.01 microfarad capacitor to reduce it.
I don't recall any diodes. It was an AO1 super regen and 3 2107. It was really a very simple design.
Okay, I think Ed and George are talking two different things. I think George is talking a crystal radio set, which we all owned at one time or another, I'm sure. And Ed is talking about a relatively simple super regenerative circuit that he got from a magazine article, that someone else got from a magazine article that he was told about. The thing that got me on electronics was taking them apart and trying to figure out how the heck they worked, and sometimes not having a clue. And then I conned my parents into getting a shortwave radio using green stamps and listened to shortwave broadcasts. And then I figured out that if I use my cheaper transistor radio as a local oscillator, I could beat it along with the AM receiver and listen to single sideband conversations. So that's how I entered down this particular road.
Oh, Roy, two comments.
Yes, Ed.
Comment one, let me be clear, it was a regenerative detector. Super regenerative is primarily used on VHF. This was actual regenerative. It was adjusted for AM, but I think it could have been tweaked to CW looking back at it, but the thought never occurred to even consider it. Second item, when I was a kid, one day my father brought home a kit for a crystal radio receiver, but that one actually used a piece of galena ore and a real cat whisker. I've never seen that since.
Ed, you could use a key, a copper key, with a little copper piece of wire and a piece of lead, the tip of a pencil, to scrape across the top of the copper key. KD2FIU. Thank you, Roy.
You can substitute a lot of things, but once in my life I went to a class act.
Yes, Ed, the galena crystal is the classic design. That's why we call it a crystal radio set. Some people don't really understand where the crystal came in. I guess they figured that it had a regular quartz crystal, later versions of oscillators that use crystal oscillator circuits for high Q. Galena, any kind of corroded material, semiconductive, will produce a non-linear signal and will act as a crude AM detector, which then gets fed to the sound-producing device and the tuned circuit and such. So there's a lot of things that you can use instead of a galena crystal, although that's the classic example. And the modern example is a germanium diode, simply because germanium is the semiconductor that has the smallest band gap and the least voltage drop. So you'll get more of the signal going into whatever sound listening device you're going to pull it into.
And more stability in frequency control than the copper key with, I remember it was copper wire wrapped around the tip of a graphite pencil tip scraped along a key, and each end of that was wired to be your detector. So the germanium diode was far more stable than doing that. KD2FIU. Thanks, Roy.
I'm hard-pressed to think of anything in any field that wasn't more stable than that. I may be right, but...
Yeah, I mean, the only problem with using things like galena or the corroded copper or what have you is you got to find a sweet spot. You know, with the germanium diode, you just plugged in the germanium diode. There was no non-sweet spot. But with these kind of neo-proto semiconductor materials, you had to move the contact around a bit before you started to hear whatever was on the radio that you wanted to listen to. And you had to keep that contact pretty much stable. But that's the only downside. I'm sure everyone out there listening tonight had played with that as a child. It was kind of a rite of passage.
KDQFIU, Roy, it was the simplicity of learning a receiver.
I don't know when I was doing it whether I reveled in the particular simplicity. I just reveled in, my gosh, it worked.
Oh, absolutely. And keep in mind, the receiver is more complex than the transmitter, even in the most modern equipment.
Okay, well, now we're going to have computers do everything. So kids aren't probably going to put together little crystal sets. I don't know exactly what they're going to put together. You know, it really doesn't translate well to software-defined radio technology.
One thought, Roy.
Yes, Ed, please.
We're not there yet. You still need some dedicated hardware between the computer and the antenna. And until that goes away, I'm happy.
Roy, please, I'm gonna back out. I know it's gonna be coming on, but I'll leave it with, as I just mentioned, receivers are more complex than transmitters, and we were learning to play with the concept of receive back then. KD2FIU, all clear.
That reminds me, Roy, you want to hear a teaser trailer?
Okay, Ed.
Remember the HRU talk I did a couple of years ago on receivers from Spark through digital?
Yes, I enjoyed listening to it.
There's some talk about I may be Shanghai Dre kicking and screaming to one or more Limark meetings to deliver some of that. Be determined.
Oh, that would be great. And, you know, I don't want to put you on the spot, but it would be nice if they videoed it and put it up. Limark, I think, has a YouTube channel these days, so that would look nice up there.
It's still very preliminary. Don't get carried away.
Okay, I'm used to a lot of reports of Hollywood deals that never take place, so don't worry. I won't be terribly disappointed. I just treat this like anything else, you know, as a possibility that might happen but might not.
On the other hand, my favorite presentations that I do not use in ham radio stuff usually have more to do with stuff like aviation.
Yeah, well, you shared that with us as well. That's in the archives at amateurradio.tv.
Yeah, but I haven't shared the one I did about the Boeing 737 MAX 8, what the hell happened.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, if you feel so inclined one of these Sundays, let me know and I'll make time for you. It was a big conversation piece. We went over it in some detail week in and week out. Hank, N1YDY, who is the pilot, commented. There were a few other people with some expertise who added to this. So if you want to, just tell me the Sunday.
I can't always guarantee, but we'll think about it. Yeah, I spoke to Hank YGY about it at some depth. By the way, Roy, you're a man of all seasons. Did you hear about the Learjet crash about a week ago outside San Diego?
No, I missed it.
Want the short answer?
Sure.
about basing a very hot, you know, corporate jet at an airport with the only runway that has all-weather landing capability is too short for that particular plane. From there, as long as the weather's good, you're okay, but dot, dot, dot.
That's a shame.
That's why they make hotels all over the place, so you can say, nope, that ain't happening. Let's check into the hotel, try again in the morning.
Yeah. I mean, accidents happen, but, allowing a really stupid situation is a terrible reason to die.
Get their itis. It's also an epidemic on Mount Everest.
Well, yeah, but, I mean, there's a difference to me about traveling for the most part. I don't know exactly why they were going where they were going, but, okay, if you want boasting rights to climb up a mountain and you're aware of the risks and you take even more risks, that's you're a big boy or a big girl. What can I tell you?
I once saw a world-famous mountain climber interview, I think it was back in the day when David Letterman was on, and the subject came up. He climbed Mount Everest 4 times and summited twice. With the other two, he said, I can summit or I can live to feel bad about not making it. Those are my choices.
Okay, there's a sane guy. I mean, there are people who are willing to take rather significant risks, but not infinite risks. So, it's kind of difficult to judge how risky is acceptable, but I prefer a guy like him than the guys who, risk is meaningless to them. They're fearless, and they usually don't live very long.
It's a real problem. It is a real problem that stuff like aviation, mountain climbing, there's a real problem with people dying for taking risks. Stupid risks.
Yeah, I think unfortunately it sort of selects with people with less, who hold risks less important than others. There's a range of risk analysis in people. It automatically runs to different degrees. There are somewhat risk-averse people who take a lot of risks. They tend to survive more than the ones who would to kind of take the case of, I'm risking my life, let me risk it to the maximum. And probably the preponderance of people who don't make it to wherever they plan to have gone.
Kobe Bryant, John F. Kennedy Jr.
Yeah, I don't know. JFK Jr., I don't know if he thought it was a risk. I don't think he was aware of a lot of things. I think he was a charming man who, the pencil box wasn't very sharp.
It's a bit of a stretch, but he was actually a victim of a murder suicide. I think his sister-in-law dared him to take the three of them up to a wedding so they wouldn't be late by taking an alternate route.
Okay, but I think you, me, and everyone listening tonight has had people suggest stupid things to them. And we all hopefully were smart enough to say, no, that won't work, and move on. So again, I'm sure he was a charming man, but I don't know if I would have hired him as a lawyer.
I know nothing about his legal skills or lack thereof, but I have studied his aviation experience and skills a fair amount, and it was bad. It was bad.
WS2N, wonder what Ed thinks about John Denver. He built his own airplane.
No, he didn't.
Wait. It's not that simple.
Okay. Sounds like you know the story, Ed. Boy, I'm going to go over that.
It's very simple. John Denver was flying what's known as an ultralight. I don't believe he built it himself, but these are very flimsy, minimal aircraft. The first rule in aviation is redundancy, backup, planning ahead, considering all contingencies. Anybody who's ever taken a serious flying lesson for their first pilot's license has been through this maybe half a dozen times. You're flying along with the instructor, minding your own business. He shoves the throttle to idle, says simulated engine failure. And then you go through the procedure of what you do if your engine dies in mid-flight. You trim the plane for best ride. Look around. Are you near an airport? If you're not near an airport, what's the softest spot you can put the sucker down on? Ask somebody about that one. They'll tell you the Hudson River. And everybody does that periodically. It's the idea to be prepared for anything. The problem with those ultralights, they don't have redundancy. They don't have backup. They don't require the same amount of training to have it pounded into your skull. Comment, Paul?
Okay, so you're saying it wasn't a kit. I assumed it was a kit. That's the way the story went years ago when he died, that it was a kit. I assumed he put it together, but apparently not. But was it an ultralight kit?
It doesn't really matter. I know a bit about kit planes also, and you have to have it checked out by an FAA inspector who is familiar with that model. If anybody is interested, look up on the internet, VAN, V-A-N, apostrophe S, aircraft, and you might find the RB-12 or the RB-14A interesting. These are kits, but they make the instructions for those old cheap kits look like, you know, cryptic nothings. I mean, the assembly instructions, it's like an encyclopedia, and it has to be checked out by the FAA before you can license it.
Okay, very good, Ed. Okay, what a shame, he was a great singer. But I remember that story. Back over to you, Ron.
Okay, I think Jim was trying to get something across. If that was you out there, Jim, please finish your thought.
Yes, the NTSB report on the John Denver crash is a very interesting read. I've read a lot of reports of analysis of deaths in certain circumstances. That was the only one I ever read of an aircraft incident, but very, very interesting. Any of you folks that have a technical nature would really get a lot out of that, reading that report, because it's telling. The design of that plane was modified by the previous owner because he wanted to make it more safe, and it didn't work out. Interesting. At least that's what the report says, if you believe the report. But the report is very interesting. Anybody who's remotely interested in it should read it. You get a lot out of it. Over.
That fellow get the plane recertified?
I'm not sure, but the report is well worth reading because it makes a great point about how many times you overdo a safety procedure before it becomes an unsafe procedure.
Yep, another thing that can go wrong in aviation.
Jim, if you have a chance, email me the link and I'll put it on my link page.
There are tons and tons of NTSB reports out there, and they're all interesting.
Most of us don't fly 737s, though. John Denver's plane is relevant because most of us might have some chance of, you know, if you were to fly a plane, it would be a little widget like that. It's a neat report. I found it enlightening as a non-pilot.
I have to disagree with that thing. If anybody out there in a vast listening audience decides you want to go out and take flying lessons, you start with a Cessna 150 or 172. They've been around for decades and decades, they're forgiving, they're rock solid. Those ultralights are really for people who are getting bored with mundane stuff and looking for a little bit of an adrenaline rush. You start off with them, you're asking for trouble.
No argument.
Okay, very good. Thanks everyone for participating in general for tonight's technical net. Thanks Jim and Ed and Paul for this topic. We'll turn it over to Paul, WS2N, for his SpaceNet report.
Thanks, Roy. This topic was better than the SpaceNet report. Very good. I'll try to find that online where you can read that about John Denver's accident. And, if you get it onto your website, Roy, I'll copy it from that. Sounds good. Yeah, anyway, there's only a few things going on with the space industry in the last, I'd say the last 3-4 weeks. There really hasn't been all that much, but the one topic that keeps coming up, if you go to any website that covers this stuff, is the James Webb Space Telescope, of course, because it's an engineering marvel. All the mechanics and technicians that were involved with this thing must be thrilled. You know, it's not sending pictures back yet. We'll have to wait until probably May for that to see what happens with first light. But all the mechanical stuff that took place, you know, hundreds and hundreds of hinges and motors and servos and clips that had to unclip. Apparently, it's all worked 100%. You know, everything from launch from the Ariane 5 rocket to the fairings opening up. The Ariane 5 even had problems with fairings last year, and there was some question on whether that was repaired properly. There was another launch before James Webb, which was successful, so they nailed that one. So that everything worked good. It got into space, and the engineers' dream came true. The technicians, when this thing started to work properly, with the first thing was the solar panel that opened up to pick up the sun, so that you could recharge its batteries, get off the battery power. The antenna unfurled, pointing back toward Earth. Things started to go very well when they started to actually deploy things. They opened up the pallets at the front and back, which contained the Mylar blankets. That all went well. The covers rolled up to expose those blankets. These booms, these telescopic booms, came out on the port side and then on the starboard side. And this is all taking, you know, each thing that I'm saying is maybe another day. Every another day they would do another thing. Pallets that contain the Mylar blankets, everything worked fine. There was one question about a problem with the pallet, but they had other sensors which showed that it was okay. So this big sun shield opened up, over 70 feet long, over 40 feet wide, which is going to protect the instrument from any kind of heat from the sun, or even a reflection of the light from the moon or the earth. This thing is in total darkness. Last week we left off at that point where the sun shield was open. But the next day after the net, they were going to start tensioning things, which means these five layers were going to separate from one another. It worked fine. I mean, you got to understand, there were no pyrotechnics on this space telescope at all. Everything was motors and solenoids and clips and pulleys all over and cables. So the five layers pulled tight and they separated from one another. During the week, they started to get involved with the mirrors. They had a secondary mirror, which was kind of like folded into the back of the thing. That came out. It's got three booms that are attached to it. And when, you know, after it opens up, it's 26 feet away from the mirror, the primary mirror. It's a very large structure, and it had to open up and lock in place. That worked 100%. Then they started to actually move the remaining mirrors there. The, you know, it contains 18 mirrors, but there were three on the port side, three on the starboard side were folded back. So, sure enough, that worked fine. The hinges worked good. The motors turned the port side. Those three mirrors locked into place. They did the same with the starboard side. And that's it. I mean, now it's on the way to its final location at the L2 location, 1 million miles out, roughly four times the distance of the moon. It's got one mid-course correction burn that will have to happen probably within a few, maybe about 5-6 days, and that will get it to the exact location that they needed at that 1 million mile location. They don't want to go too far. There's no way to bring it back. If they go too far, it'll just keep going, drifting away. They want it at that exact location. This way, it's in perfect balance with the gravitational swing of the, actually, a combination of the Earth and the Sun. And it will stay there forever. You know, they've had other space telescopes and things go to that location. You know, there has been a few, so it's not the first time they did that. But certainly the first time that they've had something this large. Now, this 21-foot diameter mirror is a little over 21 feet. All made of, it's all braced up with a beryllium backing, which means it won't expand and contract, and that's all coated with, it's got an aluminum base, and that's coated with gold, very fine gold, ready for operation. We'll see how that goes. It's got probably about a couple of more weeks before it gets to its location. It's slowed down to probably around a little below 800 miles per hour, I guess, tonight. Away from Earth, it started out at 23,000 miles, a little over 23,000 miles per hour. And it keeps slowing down and slowing down. I think it's around 800 miles per hour now. And by the time it gets out to the L2, it's going to keep slowing down to 700, 600, 500, and eventually we get down to, I guess, zero. Now, that will be it. Then all they have to do is refine the locations of these 18 mirrors. They have little actuators. Each mirror has, I think, like six actuators that could be turned on, and you can move them one way or another to have them perfectly aligned with one another, and that's going to take months to calibrate that. And I think I said that last week. They have, they're going to stare at a star, and the star's light comes down, goes to the 18 different mirrors, and then those 18 mirrors reflect the light to the secondary mirror, and then back into the charge couple device, which takes the picture. To align that, they're going to take those, they're going to stare at the one star, and they're going to take that light, and it on a charge couple of devices will probably show it each 18 different lights slightly off center, and the goal is to move each mirror one way or another until all of them are focused to one fine point, and that'll be it. So looking forward to first light probably in May. Any questions, comments, WS2X. Okay, very good. Well, that of course is the main story. I mean, there's only a few other topics that I really had. The Russians screwed up again. About a week and a half ago, they launched the Angara 5 rocket. This is one of the largest vehicles. They've only launched it, I think, one other time before. And they had a failure with it, and that was about a year and a half ago. So, Angara is going to be their family of rockets. There's going to be the Angara 5, the Angara 6, different numbers. And this is a heavy lift vehicle. You know, it's eventually scheduled to replace their heavy lift Proton rocket. But they have to work out a few little kinks. The second stage failed to make it to orbit. First stage went fine, but the second stage had some problems. And that eventually came back, I think, a day and a half later, 2 days later. And they didn't know where it was going to land. You know, it was one of these Skylab things, you know, where's it going to land? So that came through the atmosphere, burnt up, and that was the end of that. So they'll have to work on that. Russians have had a lot of problems in the space world in the last year. Actually, the last 2 years, you know, they found somebody drilled a hole in the one of their Soyuz manned spacecraft. They didn't find it until long after it was docked to the International Space Station. They had to find a way to plug that before they left and brought a crew back to Earth. They had the Nyoka module docked with the space station. Had the space station go out of control. Did 1.5 flips. It's like flipping a 30-story building 1.5 times. Before they got that under control. They had their rocket shoot another rocket out of the sky as a test to see if they could do it. And that blew thousands of pieces of debris. And, you know, it's all flying in one direction around the Earth. It's not like spread all over. It's not like going up to the North Pole or the South Pole. This stuff is just, you know, a long stream of debris, you know, many, many miles long, traveling together, going around the Earth every 90 minutes. So, you know, that could cause a problem. In fact, they said they had to cancel an EVA on the International Space Station because of that a while back. They thought the debris might get near the space station. I'm sure I can think of a few more things. Anyway, the Russians really got to get their act together. They've been quite dependable for decades, you know, sending people to Mir, sending people to the space station. No problem. Well, they had problems, I should say that, but they did everything safely. You know, they've had their Progress cargo vehicles crash into the Mir space station. But, you know, they always got around it. But these are pretty serious problems that are going on lately. Anyway, we'll see how they do in the coming years. I mean, they have goals of putting people on the moon and all that. I wouldn't bet on that. I could see China getting there, but Russia has their problems. Maybe they'll team up with China. I know they're looking to do something like that. I can see that as a possibility. But on their own, I think they're financially stressed. There was a suborbital launch from Wallops Island, Virginia, last night, Saturday night. They said if you were up looking at it, you'd be able to maybe see it even from here, but I'm not sure I had to do that. They said it was possible. The idea was to launch the diffused X-ray from the local galaxy experiment, or DXL. The idea of this NASA payload that was launched on the suborbital branch rocket, where, you know, go a couple hundred miles high, and it was going to use instruments, optical instruments, to look at X-rays, and they call it the soft X-rays, not the hard X-rays. The hard X-rays, before I would tell you, it could be used for, looking at people's bodies. But the soft X-rays can't, as far as I know, anyway. But what soft X-rays can do is screw up the ionosphere, which affects amateur radio, of course. So, interested in that flight and the results. I'm not sure what the results are yet. It only happened last night. But, they figured out that most of the X-rays are coming from outside of the solar system, probably from supernovas that have gone off over years. This one is going to detect it a little bit better than the first one that they did a while back. So interested in seeing the results from the XL flight. Any comments? WS1. Anyway, I pretty much don't have anything else for this evening. So if anybody has any questions, feel that. Now we're going to just turn it back to Roy. Any comments or questions? All quiet on the western front. Roy, over to you. WS.
AC2GS. Well, thank you very much, Paul. Paul, thanks for the SpaceNet report. Thanks for all your help in the TechNet. And thanks for all that you do for the club. Guys, I always tell you, I appreciate every last one of you guys that participate. You know, some people kind of sit back and listen to the show and critique who's talking, who's not talking, how much they're talking, what they're talking about, what have you. The people that kind of hit that push-to-talk button and participate that make or break this technical net. And I want to thank you, each and every one, once again. Want to remind people of the usual things. If you want to reach me via email, my email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, that's for mailbag questions, for topics of discussion, for technical puzzles. If you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at something, you can ask me and I'll pass it along. If you want to email him directly, that's spacenetreport@gmail.com for Paul. Links that are available for all kinds of interesting articles and such. So please avail yourself of it. You just have to type into your browser, roy.ac2gs.com. Again, roy.ac2gs.com. And that'll bring you to the link page. There is an audio stream of Glen Oaks Repeater throughout the week. You just have to type into the browser, technet.ac2gs.com, and it'll play for you. And always keep in mind Mike KC2NJI's wonderful archive site, amateurradio.tv, with more than a million visitors. He has archives of the technical net going as far back as December of 2006. So keep those all in mind. And once again, I would like to close this technical net very much like Dick K2RIW did and ask everyone to be kind to each other. It's good advice in general. It's great advice right now. Omicron is banging on the door. Please, everyone, get your vaccinations, get your boosters. If you do get infected with Omicron and you're boosted, chances are very good that it will be a rather short-term illness without too many complications. But please try and socially distance, use KN95 or N95 masks instead of the cloth ones when you're in a high-risk area. Take care of yourself, take care of each other, be well, have a safe week, stay warm, stay dry, and we'll be back to do this all over again next Sunday night. So until then, I wish you well. This is AC2GS, and I'm clear.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
got 100% everything that you said, Roy.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I thought that it triggered just as I unkeyed, so good timing, I guess.
You're correct. 73, Roy. WS2N.
Wesley, are you still listening? This is KD2VHD, Jim. This is KD2VHD. I'm chuckling to myself thinking that nobody will key up because they think if everybody hears me, they'll know I listened to that whole thing.
This is WB2EAD, so did you listen to the whole thing?
Yeah, you too, huh?
9, can't relate. But maybe you should have yourself checked out after that, that horrible experience.
Well, I have been through worse, but it takes a certain stealing of the mind and body, but now I get something out of it.
Well, the worst part of it was listening to me.
No, you're always a hoot.
Alright, good night. WB2EAD.
73Z. KD2VHD.
Limark Tech Net tonight at 8 o'clock. This is the W2VL repeater.
Net time complete. W2VL repeater.
Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73 and good night from the W2VL repeater. The time is 12:04 a.m. 73 and good night from the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater.
Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
This is the W2VL repeater. Good morning. The time is 5 o'clock a.m.
Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater.
Listening.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
K1AMR Mobile.
W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater.
NY2H, WHCDM.
W2VL repeater.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
WHCDL, anybody listening?
Not many people. KC1SAM, how you doing?
I'll go there. I'll say hello. How do you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you fine. I don't know if you're talking to me or somebody trouble with me. But I hear you fine. A little different. Your audio is a little different. But I hear you fine.
Okay, I gotta set this up. This is my new rig, finally. Finally? I had it, I bought it at Nearfest 3 years ago, and I finally took it out of the box.
I remember that, I was there. The audio is crisp and clear, a little higher pitched than the other one, but that's fine, because it'll punch through a little bit better. Well, good. Is it in the car now, or do you have it at home?
Stand by 1 second.
I'm generous today. I give you two.
Andy, the radio sounds great. WA2HMM.
No, it somehow fails. Who is the other station to call me? WA2CDL.
Andy, this is Charlie, WA2HMM, in Smithtown. The radio sounds great. And what took you so long to get it out of the box? Were you using it as a footstool?
Yeah, I could be. I have a tendency to buy things and not use them right away. So I took this out of the box. Well, since I got my antenna up, now I can use this rig. So, that's what I'm doing. I have to set it up. I didn't set it up yet. There's a lot of different things I gotta add to this radio. Or set it up. Yeah, how you doing, Charlie? Everything's good. In fact, hold on a second. I gotta see how much power I'm even transmitting with. I don't even know.
DFQ.
I should be. Let me just stand by a second. Actually, Charlie, are you a mathematician?
Who's that?
Are you into math? A mathematician or playing around with mathematics?
What about mathematics? In the kitchen?
No, I have a mathematical question I want to figure out. Interesting, not a problem, but just a question.
Did you just unkey? If not, you just broke up.
Well, it's not on my end, I'm not sure.
It's what the link has been doing. It cuts off, the carrier stays there, but there's no audio. It's not you. I switched to Glen Oaks and I can hear you.
Very good. Sam, how well are you hearing the East repeater at your location?
Oh, fine. Coming in here about more than the 30 over, you know, for my distance, that's pretty good. The audio is fine, but it's intermittent. It'll cut out the audio now and then. And at times it'll get very, very noisy. We haven't gotten noisy today, but yesterday we'd get very, very noisy. And I'll switch to Glen Oaks, which is a very weak signal, but it comes in fine.
Okay, stand by 1 second. I just want to look up something here.
Well, like I said, I'll give you two. I'll only press you up, though.
Okay, here we go. I figured it out. Now I'm bringing the power down. I don't have to run so much power. Wait a minute, hold on. Okay. Because I'm so close to the repeater. Even at this level, I'm fine.
Definitely sounds good. KC1, SAM.
Yeah, just...